Hi and welcome to Therapist Talk Therapy. I am your host, Margaret O'Connor, the BSc Programme Leader with PCI College. Today we are marking International Men's Day, which takes place on November 19th. The purpose of this day is to celebrate the positive value men bring to the world, their families and communities. It highlights positive male role models and raises awareness of men's well-being. The theme for 2023 is to eliminate male suicide. My guest for this topic is Dan O'Mahony, PCI Faculty Lecturer and Academic Support Officer. Dan studies with PCI College, completing the Certificate, Diploma and BSc in Counselling and Psychotherapy. He now works with the college as well as working with PIATA, specifically in the areas of suicide intervention, self-harm and bereavement. He works from an integrative approach and strongly values the power of relationship and connection in his therapy work. Dan generously shares his own story of being a young boy growing up into a teenage and adult man. Through the specific detail of his story, he demonstrates wider themes about how society holds very strong ideas about what it means to be a man. These include what you do for a job, how you talk, what you're allowed to enjoy as a hobby, and not. He also shows the strong response to men who don't match up to these expectations and how damaging that can be to a person's sense of self. We hope this episode is of interest to therapists and the general public. We do discuss suicide and want to highlight the supports available by sharing links to PIATA, the PCI Low Cost Counselling Service and International Men's Day in the episode information. Thank you very much for listening. So Dan, you're really welcome. I'm delighted to be talking to you here today. So yeah, as I said, we're here kind of marking International Men's Day, which is the 15th of November. And can you give us maybe an overview of why do we need International Men's Day, or what might be some of the challenges that men face specifically around their mental health?
Yeah, so I suppose the approach I'm probably going to take today is from my own personal experience and how that aided my professional and clinical work as a male in society and then a male therapist, really. I suppose that's the approach. I suppose whenever I'm doing anything, even in my professional career, there's always a sense of self for me, because that's how I learn, is seeing everything through the lens of my own life first before I ever see it through the lens of a client or somebody else. I have to understand it, I suppose, as a bit of an internal process. So yeah, I suppose that's the approach I'm going to take today, is, you know, just run through a couple of things and share a bit about my own personal journey, because I feel that really, yeah, as I go through, you'll see, I suppose, why it makes sense, I suppose, and how it's really enriched my professional work, you know? We've so many different age groups and generations of males in our society, you know? And there's a wider spectrum now of sexuality and stuff like that. But I'm going to stick to what I know and what I feel like I can speak from. So I suppose to start with my own story. So my mom and dad split up when I was 4. Okay. So I was brought up in a very female orientated environment. You know, I was reared by my mom, by my granny and by my aunts. So for a 4-year-old, Dan, let's say, like, I was taught to talk about how I feel and to be quite expressive emotionally. You know, it was okay in my household to cry and talk about how you feel. You know, I grew up listening to music like Diana Ross, Dionne Warwick, Gladys Knight, Whitney Houston, Celine Dion. So it was always a very female orientated, every aspect was, even down to kind of musical taste that I would have today, you know. So beginning primary school for me was fine. I always gravitated towards female friendships just because, as I said, mom and dad split up when I was 4. I never really had a good, solid relationship with my father, who was always kind of very inconsistent to then not at all. So I was, I know now then that, you know, 4, 5, 6-year-old Dan always gravitated towards females because that's who I trusted. That's what I grew up around, you know, and my caregivers were all female. So that's, I always gravitated towards female friendships. So, you know, during my primary school years, that was fine, you know. I suppose secondary school was where it all kind of changed for me because, you know, I mean, they were to talk like Eric Erickson's stages of development, you know, your peers then become the central point of your development and peer approval and identity versus role confusion. You know, And as a kid, I always was fascinated with getting my hair cut. I always loved, I could sit in a barber's all day watching them cutting hair. And I was like, when I get older, that's what I want to do. So when I was about 15, I wanted to get an apprentice as a barber, and I kind of fell into women's hairdressing. Someone just saw something in me and they were like, look, I think I worked in a place that was kind of unisex, and I kind of ended up kind of giving a dig out at busy periods and stuff like that. And they were like, look, we think you've got something here. So we want to invest in your training and stuff like that. So I was like, okay, it was 15, 16. And, you know, I started doing a lot of friends and family hairs, like, and you know, when you're 15 or 16, you're getting 50 quid a head for hair. I was like, this is super duper, love this. So you have this 15-year-old then who was brought up by all females, who was now a hairdresser. So peers, and as I got older, society gave me a label that was gay, right? So from 15 to 20, for me, was hell on earth. Because you're at that stage of your life where you don't really know who you are or what you're about or what you want. Like that, it's total identity versus role confusion. Who am I in the world? How do I operate? I was just acting out of a way that was natural to me and my upbringing. But obviously, as I got older and learned an awful lot more, you know, obviously I was feminine in some ways, you know, I was quite expressive. I was quite expressive. And as I said, I always kind of gravitated towards female connections. So society kind of gave me that label that never felt okay for me, you know? So, and I think it even would have happened even a little bit younger, like this whole gay thing, before I even knew what gay was, or even what sexual attraction was, or sexual orientation. It would have happened even before 15, but it kind of really came to fruition then when I started being a hairdresser. You know, I kind of got a reputation of, that was just how everybody saw me. You know, so like, that brought me, I suppose, to my knees. Like, I was plagued with anxiety and depression. I suffered from suicidal ideation because, like, I remember that was how I got into therapy, because I was like, I think the only option for me is out of this world, because I can't continue to live like this. It just felt like I was a circle being put into a square. You know, it never felt right. You know, I was like, why is everybody saying this thing about me? What's, and then there's the whole shame piece. Now, just to put out there a disclaimer, I never had my family or my friends or anything. I never had it. I remember actually saying at one stage, I wish I was gay, because I think it'd be easier. Because then I would fit this mold and this label that's been given to me.
Yeah. Okay. But it was the misfit. So like, people who didn't know you kind of forcing this identity on you as an insult. Like, it wasn't being said in a bad way.
No.
And kind of, this was insinuating that the things you were doing, the things that seemed very natural to you, were not okay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So the message I got then was, there's something wrong with me. Because for me, as I said to you, total disclaimer, like, LGBTQ plus ally here, and have no qualms about any kind of sexual orientation or anything like that. Nor would my family, if I was a gay man. Like, my family are so open-minded and so supportive. But it was like that. It was used as a way to bully me and to nearly shame me into, you're not fitting. This is not the way a man is supposed to be. This is not what you're supposed to do. You don't talk the way you're supposed to. You don't dress the way you're supposed to. You don't work at what you're supposed to do. You don't have interest in, like, I mean, I'd no interest in football or anything like that. I still sing to this day, amateurly, but I love it. And I've always sang. So I just never fit the mold of what a male should have been, or what at that time was being funneled into me of what I should be. I just essentially was getting the message that I'm not who I should be, when I didn't even know who that was at that time. So I suppose that's what happened to me. And so, like, as I said to you, 15 to 20 was just hell, like really, 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 really bad, really, really bad anxiety, and just constantly feeling depressed. Like, I was just lost, totally lost, and forever just sad. It was just plagued with sadness. It was like there was this black cloud over my head that everybody else could see, that I didn't know how it got there. I didn't put it there, and I didn't know how to get rid of it. And I remember saying, then I got to the point then, that's when I said, I have to go to therapy, because I said, I think the only way for me is suicide. Because as I said, I don't want to die, but I can't continue to live this life that I'm living. Because like, as I get older then, Margaret, you know, you're going out to nightclubs and that. And like, I mean, everywhere I was getting this assumption. People were just automatically assuming, because a lot of my friends were female, or somebody would know somebody that knows somebody. And they were like, oh, he works in the hairdressers here. And it was just a natural assumption. Like, people would come up to me and say, are you still working in such a place? And, you know, have you got a boyfriend or anything like that? Like, that would be the style of question. And it was like, at the time, I remember thinking nobody has a right to ask somebody those questions. Like, I mean, but it was just such ill fitting for me. And I just felt so lost in it all. And that's when I suppose I went and saw therapy and I remember being in my first therapy session because I in my family dynamics, I suppose when you come from parents that have broken up, there's an awful lot of your family dynamic changed. I was the only child. My mom worked really hard to keep a roof over her head, you know, so I was reared by my gran and my aunts. So I remember going to my first therapy session. As I said, like my family dynamics had changed, and there was other stuff. Like, look, no family is perfect. But I remember going to my first therapy session, and I remember saying to the therapist, you know, I feel like nobody understands it. And it wasn't even the whole people are saying I'm gay. It was just like, nobody understands me, because I feel like I had to grow up quicker than my years. So my maturity was always a hell of a lot older than my age. So my peers were like, I don't know what to say to you. I've never gone through anything like that. And then, you know yourself, some adults can be guilty of kind of saying, ah, sure, you're 15 or 16. What problems would you have? You know, you're young, enjoy your life and don't be worried about these things. So I kind of was like, well, the adults in my life don't get it. And the people my old age don't get it. So who do I go to? Where do I turn to? And that's when I went to a lovely therapist who just got it. And I was like, oh my God, this man really gets this. He was nearly finishing my sentence. It was just that total core conditions. You know, I felt so seen and so heard and so validated in how tough my experience was. Because I think there was a lot attached to, for me, thinking like, I don't really have any real problems. Like, there's nothing really, I don't live in an abusive home. I'm not going without food. I'm not neglected. People are talking about me, big deal. There was that element where he was kind of saying, well, what you're going through is pretty horrific, you know, and there's no surprise that you feel you've been brought to a place where you're contemplating suicide, you know? And I think that was the moment when I was like, this is what I want to do. I have to figure out how to become a therapist, because I want to be able to create that space for people, and people that felt like I did, that nobody understood them. So that was the moment, I suppose, that I decided to become a therapist. It was just kind of that. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to get there. I was only 21, so I was too young to do any courses. I had looked into a lot of different places. I'd done like a level 5 in psychology and a level 5 in human growth and development, and I had planned to go to a college in city centre. And I was on this course, and this lady said to me, a friend of mine is training as a therapist at the moment. She goes to PCI. And I was like, oh, I've never heard of them. They're in Clondalkin. And I looked up PCI and I was like, oh my God, it's so much closer. The fees were so much more manageable. So like, I was 21 at the time. So for 2 years, I waited until I could enroll in PCI. I turned 23. At the time, you had to be 23 to start CERT. So I turned 23 in the June, and I enrolled on the CERT in PCI then in the October.
Wow, amazing.
So that was my therapy journey. The whole sexuality piece then, I suppose, got bigger, because what happened then is I had gone through a couple of years of therapy, and you now was working with me as a colleague, and I've always kind of been like this. I've always kind of been an open book, and I was like, if I'm ever going to do anything, I always say, if it comes out of my mouth, I'll own it. And if I'm ever going to do anything, I call the shots and I dance to my own tune. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from what I've always been through, you know, like, I'm going to call the shots in my own life. So I remember having this kind of really, I took taken a break from therapy, and I was around 23 at the time, and I was like, everybody has put this label on me. It's been with me now for the past 7 years. And I remember comparing it to a friend of mine. I know this is really probably, I don't know if it's even inappropriate to say, but it was like, you know, you tell somebody that's really thin, they're fat, they're going to eventually develop disordered eating, because even though they look in the mirror, rationally, they know they're a thin person, but they eventually see somebody that's overweight. Mm. If you tell somebody something for so long. So I got to a place then where I thought, everybody is saying this. Strangers are saying it when I meet them. People are always assuming this. So it must be true. But I was like, but I know I'm not gay. That doesn't, that just doesn't fit for me. So I was like, okay, yeah, I think I'm bisexual. So I kind of said that to my family and said it to my friends. And at the time, I remember going on same-sex dates. Look, it was all very PG. Not that that's any way, shape or form. But I remember then guys saying to me, Dan, I think you're straight. I thought, Jesus Christ, where do I fit in at all? You know, and it was nearly like, it's something like when I came out, let's say, forced with this, I was like, this is very freeing for me. And I was like, now I feel like I own it. And I was like, well, people are making an assumptions. Well, they're kind of half right then. So there was that kind of freedom. And I felt like, well, at least I'll shut them up now. At least this will probably all stop now, you know. And like that, I didn't really know if that fitted for me. So I tried to explore. As I said, it was all very PG. Nothing really ever came of it. And I kind of thought, this still doesn't feel right for me. And I was like, look, it's all new to you. Just give it time, blah, blah, blah. So like that went on for about a year and a half. Then I went back to therapy and I was like, what gives here? This is like a 15, they were telling me I was gay. I came out as bisexual, started dating men. They're telling me I'm straight. So I remember having really in-depth conversations with a new therapist I was with at the time, you know, and we were talking about an awful lot of different things. And I was like, so yeah, just something. It was back to that kind of trying to put a circle into a square, or a square into a circle or whatever. You know, something wasn't fitting. Something just wasn't fitting. It just didn't feel authentic. It didn't feel right for me. And I remember my therapist saying, look, I'm going to say this statement to you, right? And she was like, just sit with it for a minute. And if I'm wrong, you can tell me I'm wrong. Because we had a really good rapport with one another. And she said, I feel the whole coming out piece was never for you. It was for everybody else. And it was for you as the 15-year-old, 16, 17, 18, up to 20, 21, whatever. You would start coming to therapy and knowing you wanted to be a therapist and doing an awful lot of work on yourself. Like the therapist said to me, that was your sense of regaining control of something. Well, people are always saying this about me. Well, then I'm going to grab a hold of this then and I'm going to run with this. Yeah. But then the reality was, it still didn't fit. Yeah. You know? So if you, like you fast forward then a couple of years, so I was 26 at the time and met at the time was the love of my life and who was the mother of my daughter, who I have a very healthy co-parent relationship. And I remember when I met her at 26 and I remember talking to friends and, you know, we'd started seeing each other and I had this burning thing in me that like, I was like, I have to tell her all this about my past because what if she knows somebody that knows me and they say something and then she's like, well, you never tell me about that. Or I don't know how I feel about that. It was always like this shameful secret that I was carrying because then I was like, I done this public announcement and made this announcement to everybody. And then I was essentially had to take it back because I was like, actually, no, I don't think that that's really who I am. So at 26, I met at the time my lovely partner and took me weeks to, I was sick to my stomach having to have this conversation of the whole journey. And then I was like, you know, this is going really well. I really like this girl. What if she doesn't understand it? Because when I started training in PCI and we were doing all the sexuality pieces and the personal development pieces, I was always saying, you know, society has dictated my life through no fault of my own. They told me who I was. And now that I know 100% who I am, like today, I identify as a heterosexual male. That's just who I am. But, you know, my classmates got it. And I remember saying, society still dictates the way my life is going to be because it could inhibit the life partners that I chose because of a reputation that I might have or somebody that I could be seeing could be influenced by, oh, I don't know, I heard a rumor that, you know, he was once dating men. How do you feel about that? So I always had this piece of like, there's still an essence of society telling me or dictating how my life is going to unfold. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. So, I mean, there's that real contradiction, as you said, between how you viewed yourself, and this was, didn't sound like you had any problem viewing yourself like that. Like, it was okay. You could make sense of the fact that I'm a man, I express my feelings, I work as a hairdresser. That could all fit for you, but it didn't fit with other people.
No.
It was that piece that made it difficult for you. Yeah.
So, like, I met my partner at the time, and true to my word, I know what we think about, we bring about, I wonder, did I kind of wish it upon myself? So my partner at the time was like, look, none of that phases me. You know, I'm in love with you. That's all that matters. It's you and us, or you and I and our future together. I don't really care what anybody else thinks. I know you, you know me, and that's what matters to us. But what happened at the time was a guy that I went to school with knew somebody connected to my partner. So I suppose mentioned things about my past. So a friend of a friend then went and told my partner's sister, my partner's family found out about it, and they weren't very comfortable with this. So, you know, we had that battle at the start of our relationship where people were saying, you know, are you sure you want to settle down with him? You know, what if you get married and you have a child and then he leaves you for another man? And of course, I was absolutely distraught by this because I felt, I remember going back to therapy saying, I feel like I've been catapulted back to being 17 again. Like I've no say in the world, like everything, all the work that I've done on myself and how grounded I am myself, I feel like that's all been lacerated. It was like it was being stripped away from me. Like people were still saying what they were saying when I was 17, and after all of this blood, sweat and tears, to the point of me being brought to my knees, to, you know, coming out with this statement that I never really felt was mine at the time, I thought it was, but on reflection it was for everybody else, it was for society, it was for me to try and gain some control over my own life. So we had that really hard, we were 26, we got together, and then there was this, my parent accepted, but there was people in our life that weren't very nice about it, you know. And like I remember saying to my therapist, like, I feel like the level of shame that I'm carrying around, like, as if, do you know what I mean, it was like a really dirty, shameful thing that I was supposed to have done. And they were like, are you sure you want to get involved with all that? It was just horrific.
And just shows the power of those assumptions. So again, you know, when you were younger, like, okay, well, you know, this is what we think a man looks like, and because you're not taking those boxes, we have a problem with that, even though you're fine. And then again, you're okay, your partner's okay, but other people are not okay. Like, are you any more or less likely to cheat on her with a man or a woman? Like, does that, you know, does that?
Yeah.
Why are you thinking about that?
But I suppose this is the big piece, like this is the societal impact that we have on, like, I know my story is quite specific, but there is a perception of how males should be, how they should operate in the world, you know, this like toxic masculinity, you know, and men should be the breadwinner and they should be the one that are in control, you know, don't talk about feelings or emotions, you hold the fort, that's your role. So I mean, I know this quite specifics to my own story, but was still a part of society telling me as a male how I should be, what the code of conduct was, how I should speak, how I should act, who I should date, who I should not date, where I should work, how I should dress, who I should associate with. I feel that for males' mental health, there's always that big piece. And that's why I think it's so important that I share my own stories, because I think that's what equipped me to work with males in the therapy room, is because, like, look, I get it. Yeah. I get what it's like when you've no control over, because everybody else is telling you how you should be, or you've grown up nearly being brainwashed to know that it's not okay to cry, or we shouldn't really behave like that, because that's not really the societal norm for us males. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I'm just thinking there's such a contradiction. So on the one hand, we think, oh, those views of men are old-fashioned or outdated, but you see, once you kind of step outside of that, I suppose it's almost like a backlash or the discomfort, other people's discomfort of you doing masculinity differently.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very powerful thing.
And I see so much, you know, on social media, and like we live in a world of toxic positivity, but I also think we live in a world with pop psychology. Yeah. And there's so many people that put up, you know, it's okay not to be okay, and men deserve to be able to cry. But like when you use, let's say, my story, and I was like, well, I spoke about feelings. I was very expressive. I grew up in a household where I knew it was okay not to be okay, but yet society labeled me as something that wasn't me.
Mm.
So there's always that kind of paradox, I think, you know, there's this like we need to promote men being open and men talking about feelings. You know, I looked up, I can't remember the exact, but I will find out exactly where it was. But there was a research done. I found it through like, it was like the, I think it was through the HSC, but there was a research done in 2018 from 18 to 24 year olds. And the reasons why they don't, or the reasons why they reach out for mental health, and also what stops them. And it was acceptance from peers, self-medicating from alcohol, fear of homophobic responses, and traditional masculinity ideas.
Wow. Okay.
So that was research done in 2018 of reasons why people don't reach out. And I mean, like, you know, it's gotten better, but in Irish society, there was that kind of, you know, those real old school males that were like, ah, sure, you don't talk about that kind of stuff, you know, stiff upper lip, man up, you have to just get on with it. And we know as therapists then that leads to years of repression. Yeah. And then it leads to an avalanche then, or a tsunami, as I'd call it, you know, if things then spill over. And I think that's why the male suicide rate is always much higher. I said that to you, didn't I, about the suicide rate?
Just before we started. So yeah, do you want to say it now again? Just
yeah, so I looked on at the gov.ie. So it was the CSO, so it was the Central Statistics Office. So in 2022, there was 412 deaths registered that had died by suicide, and 341 of those was male.
Yeah, well.
But I know from my other therapeutic work in Pieta, and working with suicide intervention, that's what happens. Like I always say, there's always a common theme, I think, with males. Younger males nowadays are much more vocal. Mental health is less of a stigma. But there's always that part of, there's still that age-old irrational belief that males should be stronger than females. You know, and I always say to clients, you know, that is an irrational belief, because emotions, feelings don't distinguish a gender. Yeah. So you experiencing sadness is no different to your sister or your mother. Circumstances may be different. Hormones may be different. Biology may be different. But we all, feelings and emotions are universal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there's so much, I suppose, even that, like, feelings are so value laden, you know, I suppose. I know from my work, like, as a general theme, women have not been given permission to be angry. You know, that's not a good thing to do. But I don't think men are even, it might be more excused, but nobody is really taught how to be healthily angry. The same as any other option. It's, you know, put to one side and, oh, let's not talk about that. So then we don't, we wonder, why does it come out in bursts, or, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, I mean, you fit a nail on the head there. And how males deal with a lot of things is true anger. So there is kind of an outburst, or, like, you see an awful lot of young males that are going to therapy that have, or just even, like, in society. Like, I remember, like, working in news agents when I was training to be a therapist, and so many guys coming in with their hands in a cast, and I'd say, what happened to you? And they were like, oh, I had a freak out in school and punched a concrete wall. You know, all this kind of thing. And I would see an awful lot of that in my work, like, guys, you know, punching themselves, or, you know, that the self-harm is a big thing as well, because they're like, I guess, so frustrated with myself that's a way of release, you know. And I think anger is a common theme for a lot of males presented in therapy, and I always say to them, but that's been your way to feel like you're in some sort of control, because if you were to look at what may be underneath the anger, maybe you want to sit and have a good cry, but that maybe wasn't that what was taught to you. Whereas where if we kick a chair or we punch a wall, we feel like we're being masculine and we're in control, and it makes us appear stronger, and, you know, that more masculine kind of perception. But I think what happens when a lot of people come to Pieta, it's that kind of avalanche or tsunami of so much repression over so many years, and so much lack of emotional intelligence. And what I mean by that is not being able to actually, I don't know how I feel.
Yeah.
Or I don't know one feeling from another.
Yeah. They're all tangled up. Yeah.
You know, so a lot of the work is like, well, let's start with the basics, you know, do you check in with yourself? But a lot of males that I've worked with is like, I couldn't tell you whether I'm sad or disappointed or angry or what, or like they might say, well, I know I'm a bit anxious, but there's always like, you have like the anxiety iceberg, as I call it, or the anger iceberg. And there's millions of other stuff in that pot that's been festering for years and years, and it's fermented, and it's been avoided, and it's been repressed, and it's been buried, and it's too scary to open it up. But something happens and it's like, you know, it's like a jack in the box then. And then it's like, I don't know how to cope.
I'm just trying to imagine, or would people tell you, like, what is it like for them to come in and, I suppose, sit with another man and have those kinds of conversations? Would they share that with you?
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, you do find, I know from managing PCI counseling service for a long time, there's a lot of males that would even call and ask for a male therapist, just for, I suppose, some familiarity, even just to sit across from another male. I think in my work, where I can model that, well, look, I've been vulnerable, and, you know, I've been here before, and, you know, I share with all my clients that, well, look, I was a client of Pieta once upon a time. So there's hope for all of us. Do you know what I mean? But I always create that, I suppose it comes back to that, really, those core conditions, and creating a space where somebody feels held and supported and seen. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I suppose a lot of feedback that I would get was like, well, you know, I didn't even realize that I didn't know one feeling from another.
Yeah.
Or it's great to be able to sit across from a man that can actually identify his own feelings. Obviously, every client looks at us as therapists as if we have our life all sussed, and, you know, and we are the one with all the answers. And I just say to them, look, that's not the case at all. It's just, as trained as a therapist, we have to do an awful lot of work on ourselves. So I said, that comes from years of training and years of tears and being in your chair. You know, I always say to every client, you know, in order for me to sit here, I had to sit where you were. I will do for the rest of my professional journey from time to time, and dip in and out. Mm. But I do think there is something about modeling a male that promotes vulnerability and questions society. And I question society in the therapy room an awful lot. You know, all those irrational beliefs and the shoulds and the musts. Like, you know, we do laugh, you know, as you know from work with me, I bring humor into everything. So like my clients even sit in front of me now, and when they say should or must, and they're like, oh yeah, sorry Dan, there I go again, because I do always say, in accordance to who? We should pay our taxes because the revenue will come after us, so we should abide by the law or we're going to get arrested. But who, tell me who says you should do that or you should operate like that? You know, I said 9 times out of 10 that's an irrational belief that you have carried. But even that, having that for them, they're like, oh my god, like, you are so right. Nobody has ever said that's how I should. It's just something that's been drilled into me, or something that I picked up along the way and I've just obviously held on to.
Yeah.
You know, I remember in my training days working with a guy that was in his 60s, and he came in to me and he was like, I've given this counseling stuff a bash before, and I've been before a therapist and it hasn't worked for me, and blah, 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 blah. So I was like, okay. I remember in my head as a trainee therapist thinking, okay, no pressure here anyway. But we worked together for a long time because I was like, well, then tell me what didn't work and tell me what do you want? Yeah. And I think that, you know, we can always say, you know, you can look at, you know, Grow is mental. They do a lot of men's mental health support. And, you know, there's the likes of Aware and, you know, the Irish Men's Shed Association. There's all those kind of things. But I always say it's a case by case basis. I think when a client sits in front of you in difficulty, it's like, what's going on for you? Mm-hmm. And what, like I always say to clients, tell me what brought you here or what made you think, you know, I need to go and get some help.
Yeah.
And then it's about uncovering them as the male in their relationship, the male in their family, the male that they've been in society. You know, what makes you sad? What makes you happy? You know, do you know what your trigger points are? Are you aware of what beliefs that you're carrying that you may have now outgrown? And I always question everything that comes from those irrational beliefs, like those shoulds and musts and I should do this as the man of the house, or I should, this is my role as the father or the partner or the brother, you know. And I always say, in accordance to who? There's these unwritten rules that we have in life and family and like these societal norms and conforming as males, but like, does it fit for you? Does it work? Like, so you've been doing that up until now and now you're in therapy because something's not working anymore. So what's not working?
It sounds like moving from a place of real restriction and isolation to much more flexibility, like bringing in those ideas of choice and connection. So even if they're only connecting with you or whoever, you know, they're still, yeah, that feels very significant. And I know that's what we want to do all the time in our therapy, but just the way you're describing it sounds really important. Like what you found, you know, finding someone who gets you just gives so much relief.
I think so. I think like when it comes to this kind of thing, it's all about the connection.
Yeah.
Because a lot of males that come to therapy haven't even been able to connect with themselves. There's a total disconnection. You know, I often find myself saying, stop thinking your way over feeling. Mm-hmm. Or I said, you're telling me how you're thinking, but I want you to tell me how you're feeling.
Yeah.
Like we'd have a joke sometimes with some of the males and I was like, oh, I cracked you. I knew you'd shed a tear this week. So I often keep it light, but it's about a connection. And my thing with any client, not just male clients, is look, for as long as you're with me, I will have your back. And when you're in this room, my job is to create a space where you feel held and where you feel supported and where you don't feel judged. And I always joke and I'd say, with the work I've done on myself and the amount of clients I've seen, very little shocks me. And then I obviously just highlight the only limits of my confidentiality is if you're at risk to yourself, somebody else is at risk, or there's a child at risk. That's when I have to break. But anything else that happens in this room is between you and I, and it's teamwork. You know, I find, especially with males, it's talking the talk and walking the walk. So you got to come down to their level. I deal with all my clients, but especially with the male clients, I just say, well, look, the way this is going to work is we're a team now. So yeah, I'm the person, I'm the professional. Mm-hmm. So, but you're the professional of your own life and of yourself. My job is to help you navigate your way to getting back to that, mm-hmm. so that we can get rid of all those irrational beliefs and get rid of all those ideas that have been implanted in your brain from everybody else. And it's about you returning back to yourself so you know what fits for you and what doesn't fit anymore.
Just as you mentioned it there, I'm curious about the crying, because, you know, some clients, I think clients have interesting view. Sometimes they think, yeah, it is a success if they get through a session without crying. Or some people, you know, happily cry, if you can do that, happily cry for the whole session. Is it different for men? Do you think it means something more?
Yeah, because it's like that masculinity, you know, it's taught to be, you know, stiff upper lip, you know, and just because I'm here talking about it, like I'll talk about my feelings, but I don't want to cry about them and stuff like that. And sometimes it's just a case of, you know, I do always say, I'm never going to push you into doing anything, saying anything. I will challenge you, but I challenge you because I've got your back, and because I want you to get the best experience from the therapy so that you can grow and evolve and change. But I often would just name, I'd say, sometimes I would say to clients, you know, I'm getting a sense that there's a heavy sadness in your eyes today, or, you know, you're presenting a little bit different today, you know, and I would just check in with them and say, how do you feel about that? And some of them would be like, some have burst into tears and was like, oh geez, Stan, I really needed that, or like that. It's almost like I didn't even realize that was there until you brought that to my attention.
Yeah.
You know, but there is that big, it's like that stigma and that taboo of like I worked with a couple of males and they'd be grabbing tissues and trying to manly wipe the tears and say, oh God, I'm sorry about this. I'm such a wimp. And I'm like, would you give it over? Like, I said, I told you before, you don't, tears is one thing you don't apologize for in here anyway. But there is that part of you saying sorry for crying. Like, yeah. Or like those comments of, oh God, I'm such a wimp, or I'm such a wuss. Jesus God, what you must think of me. I'm on me on my fourth or second session and I'm crying. And I'm like, remember what I said? We don't have any judgment in here. And I don't want you to apologize for being yourself for crying. So that's not something you ever have to worry about with me. But there is always that kind of, yeah, it's always that piece that they carry of like, oh God, like, I can't believe I fell apart that much. Or you might be working with a client for a while and you find that they give 98% to the therapy, but there's always that piece, and sometimes they will name it. They're like, I can't go there because if I fall apart, I won't even be able to speak.
And you know, it's interesting, I suppose we've obviously noticed in the college, you know, there are more men coming as students, and those numbers increased. So certainly when I trained, you know, we had two, and we thought we were,
yeah,
we should have two in the class.
Yeah.
I think we had a class, was it last year, where it was half and half for the first time ever between male and female students. So we're definitely seeing more men interested in training, which is fantastic, because
absolutely
it is a female dominated profession, but you know, we want to have more balance in it. Do you think more men are coming for therapy?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think because as well, I think like that the younger generation, so you know, people's sons and younger brothers or nephews and that are kind of, you know, like, well, I've been to therapy and it helped me. So I think because the younger generation now are so pro therapy and mental health and emotional well-being, that it's kind of rubbing off then on the older males about coming to get help, you know. But I always, the sad part for me with PAT is it's the males that have got to the point where they can cope.
Yeah.
You know that, because it's years and years of oppression. But there's definitely more, like even in general counseling, I know from colleagues of mine and even private work, there's absolutely more males reaching out now for help. Because I think as an Irish society, aside from even men, like there was once upon a time where you were like, it was kind of like, I'm going to a counsellor, you know, or like, or counsellors are only for the maddies, you know, or mental health. Have you got mental health? Does that mean you're mental? You know, there was this kind of thing that was in our culture anyway. It was like, oh, you don't say mental health unless you are mental. You know, even the name was kind of like, but I think that's changed as a society, even in the attitude to mental health, which has a knock-on effect on men and mental health. And as I said, then the younger generations now coming up are so pro-therapy that they're like talking to their dads and their granddads and their uncles and their great uncles and their older brothers. And you find an awful lot of that, like referrals are like, or I had a cousin that came to you, or I had somebody else that recommended you that you dealt with, those kind of things, you know. But there's definitely more males coming for therapy, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, do you have any advice? Because as you said, it's so easy to say those things or reshare on whatever social media, you know, all those kind of cliches. But in terms of maybe therapists listening, or indeed people who might be curious about therapy, I suppose, do you have any advice on, I suppose there are two different questions. A, I suppose, what might help men engage in therapy, or for therapists, you know, what do they need to be thinking about, something specific, I suppose, when men come to them?
I don't think it's one of those, like, I mean, I suppose the core of me as a therapist, as a practice, is always humanistic. Like, I'd use psychodynamic and CBT stuff all the time, but my core is humanistic, and I always vouch for working, especially working with males, because you're modeling a connection with you, which will lead to a connection or reconnection with themselves. So I don't think there's a preferred method. Obviously, we know somebody, it's like two clients present with anxiety. You know, CBT might work for somebody else and the other person just wants to be heard. So I think it's case by case basis. I think, you know, some men like that kind of quite structured approach. Like, you know, I've some guys that come to me, they love the CBT stuff, but from, I do it from a psychoeducational piece. I don't just purely practice from one modality. I incorporate it, but I think the backbone of it is the connection. Because you're modeling a connection. You're modeling it's okay to be vulnerable and to talk about feelings, and let me help you educate yourself on feelings and being able to identify. You know, I always say to them, you know, I want you to think about it, I call it a brain floss with them. Mm-hmm. Like I say, so I said, do it when you're brushing your teeth or do it when you're in the shower. So you're brain floss, I said, it's you're cleaning your mind out from all the negativity or anything that's going on. So I always encourage them to get into a habit of checking in with yourself on a daily basis, but incorporate in your, so I do say to them, when you have your shower and change your jocks, don't forget to floss your teeth and floss your mind, right? So I said, it's part of your hygiene now, right? It's your brain hygiene. So I said, it's just starting off simple. I do say, ask yourself, how am I feeling today? Or what do I need?
Okay.
And as simple as that. I said, and do it while you're getting dressed or while you're having your morning coffee or while you're in the shower, while you're brushing your teeth. Even if it's not in the morning, it's more productive, I think, in the morning, because that's how you're starting off your day. So it, for me, I think it's the connection. The connection is where you're going to get the most from men coming to therapy, because it's about, tell me who you are, tell me about your story, and tell me what's brought you here. Yeah. You know, because that's how you're going to find out. And it's that trust, because I think a big thing for males is trust, you know, because they don't trust themselves enough to express emotions or express feelings. So they need to have the trust in you in order to be able to get that connection and the trust within themselves, to be able to let go or open up.
And I mean, I know, you know, everything we're saying is applicable to everybody, you know, there are general principles and it will impact everyone in different ways. But I think what your story has demonstrated to me is just how insidious that social pressure is. And look, you know,
100%,
you know, again, nobody is exempt from social pressure, and women have different issues. And that's all, you know, we've talked about that separately. But just that piece of how it was just not okay to kind of take a step out of what was expected. So that might apply to people in all kinds of different ways, but, you know, then if you feel you have nowhere to go with that, there's like another layer of impact. So yeah, that isolation and that shame for absolutely no reason, you know, is really, really impactful. I think that's probably what I'm going to take away from today. But yeah, it's something to, I suppose, both for everybody, again, for anybody listening who might think, oh gosh, yeah, how does that relate to me, or, you know, does that relate to me in some way, but for therapists as well, just to maybe keep that in mind. You know, sometimes I'm thinking, we, you know, there's so much going on in the world today and there's so much to think about, you can almost forget on that really core level, who are you, how much permission do you feel you have to be yourself in daily life, and if that's taken away from you in some way, that's really, really impactful. Yeah,
I mean, absolutely. Like in the prep up to this podcast, like I've often found myself scrolling on Instagram, and everything that people were promoting, like this pop psychology stuff, which, I mean, is great. It's like encouraging men to speak out. But my thing always was, in my instance and my experience, I'd done all that. But I was moved from this box to this box. Do you understand what I mean? So like, it was like, reach out and men can cry and men can be open and men be yourselves and talk about how you feel. And I was like, okay, so we still are promoting that. But let's say in my instance, where I know, as I said to you, it's a specific story. But I done that in the past. And if 23-year-old Dan was 23 in the year 2023, what people are promoting for men's mental health wouldn't have worked for me, because I was doing that anyway, you know. And then I always, like, I remember years ago, I would see stuff like that back then. It was before Instagram, it was Facebook. And I was like, how hypocritical. Like, I do all that and now you're telling me that I'm this, not this. So I think for males, like, I suppose the reason I was sharing my story is because I suppose it can speak to many people, even if it's not a sexuality piece. It's still that society is telling you who you should be, who you should be with, who you should not be with, how you should dress, how you should behave, how you should speak, where you should go, what you should do with your life, what you shouldn't do. So that was always a theme for me in my life, you know. And I think in the therapy space, I've been able to resonate with males because you could have, you know, I remember working with a client and he was like, if we spoke up at home, you know, you got a smack. So that was, that shut you down. So I grew up never expressing how I felt and carrying the burden for everybody, you know. And it was an older male and he was like, and when you went to school and you spoke out of turn, you got a smack there. You know what I mean? Now, I couldn't relate to having that experience in my home and in my schooling, but I could relate to somebody else keeping me quiet or putting me somewhere that I didn't belong or telling me how I should behave and how I should speak or not speak up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you understand what I mean?
I do. And I think that's a really important theme, as I said, and as you said, not to get too caught up in the details necessarily, but that theme of, I suppose, freedom of expression and allowing people to be comfortable as they are. Because as you said, when we get those messages, oh, you know, it's okay to be okay and share and all that, that's a real, it's putting the responsibility back on the individual. And of course, the individual has a part to play. But if the wider system
doesn't accept it or doesn't... Yeah.
Like, only say it if it's this, because we'll only accept this tiny amount of things, everything else isn't okay, then that the system is the problem, not the...
Yeah. And I know it's a very heteronormative phrase, but I remember watching Brené Brown, you know, and she said, show me a man that can sit with a woman that's vulnerable and doesn't try and fix her. Or show me a female that can sit with a man when he's vulnerable and can cope with that. And they're people that have done work on themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like that. And that's another part of the whole male thing, is that we try and fix everything, you know. But yeah, I think that the big thing from today is society telling somebody how they should act, because as I said to you, okay, mine included a sexuality label that was given to me that wasn't mine, but it brought me to a place where thankfully I am, but I potentially couldn't be sitting here today and doing what I'm doing and helping as many people as I could, because I got to the place where I was like, well, I don't want to die, but I can't live this life anymore. I can't. How do I, like, for me, it was just like a cage. You know, I've been put in this place by everybody else, and everybody else has these assumptions, but that's not who I am, and nobody seems to be listening.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really, really powerful.
You know, and I think that's helped me, as I said to you, like, for different males that present nothing to do with my story, but coming in saying, well, that's just the way I was operated, or that's just the way I operate, or that's the way I've always been, or that's the way I was kind of conditioned to be, or so I can always relate to the people telling you how you should act, or society telling you how you should act. That's the big piece for me for today. You know, and I know you said to me about therapists, but I think, you know, with guys, it's walking the walk, talking to talk, and creating the connection. And I know we can say that transpires across everywhere, but I think it's really important, especially with people that just have no sense of identity or emotional intelligence, as in, and I hate saying that because it's like, well, what am I then, emotionally unintelligent? But I just mean, well, like, I can't tell one emotion from the other, I differentiate how I feel. So I think it's, they need to trust you, and you need to be concrete and authentic in yourself. You know, so that was the big part for me, is that now I can comfortably sit in my own skin. And it's, what's really funny now is it doesn't not never happen. People still sometimes make those assumptions about me that they did in the past, but I don't know whether I don't notice them as much anymore, or they don't happen as much anymore. Either or, it's just, or I'm just not aware of it as I used to be, but it doesn't seem to be like it used to be. Those assumptions don't seem to come across as much anymore to me. And I don't know, it's because I'm comfortable in my skin, but it was a long road in therapy for me to get there. So that's another thing. As I said, I know these are messages that transpire across all platforms, that we have to be, as the therapist, to be comfortable in the chair and quite grounded. But I think, yeah, when you're working with somebody that has never had this space, therapy is going to be quite alien for them, you know, especially, and the whole society piece. So yeah, sorry, I think I'm repeating myself now at this stage.
No, no, I think it's a really good summary. So, you know, I'd hope that if there are any men listening, that hopefully it might give them an insight into, we're not saying therapy is the only option, but obviously we're advocates for it and think it can be hugely helpful, finding the right fit and the right connection and taking that big leap of faith that, you know, it is hard. There's no point saying it's not.
Yeah.
But that you can be met, you know, and be met and form a connection in a really powerful way that can be really helpful. Also for therapists listening, I suppose maybe just to refocus on, I suppose, you know, it can be, I won't say it's easy, but, you know, because this is our work and you know, we get used to being in this context, but remembering how difficult it can be for somebody to come in and remembering that, you know, if somebody has never been given permission for the tools to explore how they feel, like that's a hugely, hugely important thing that we can help them with, and not to skip over that, you know, that's really important. Spend time on that. Yeah.
And I think as well, anybody that's tuning in, that's listening, that isn't a therapist or a member of the general public that might listen to this for whatever reason, just reach out and speak to somebody that you can trust, because I find it's a bit of a domino effect. You might speak to a friend that had a brother or somebody else and they were like, well, they actually went to see this guy or this girl in this place and it really, really helped them. I find a lot of people get into therapy like that because they spoke up and it was like, you know, well, I actually spoke to a friend of mine and they said, well, I've been in therapy. And it's like, oh, okay. Or I know my brother or my brother-in-law or cousin or whatever has been in therapy and it really helped them. Why don't you think about it? And I think sometimes that can help as well. So anybody tuning in that is struggling and is afraid to reach out, it's you know, talk to somebody that you can trust. Because you might surprise yourself of many people that are in your circle already that have actually been in therapy or know somebody that's been in therapy or that's in therapy and can see the difference and the impact that it's made.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, Dan, I want to thank you so much for being so honest and so generous in sharing your story. And I think, you know, again, showing how you live authentically and honestly. And I really do. I'm quite sure it would be really helpful to people listening today. Is there anything else?
Look, it's no problem. As I said to you, we know as therapists, we can only talk about things that we've worked really, really hard on. This stuff doesn't trigger me anymore because it's a part of my story and it got me to where I am today. So I hope, even though people may resonate exactly with the specifics of the story, it's the message that I'm trying to get out there is the societal pressure, conformity, and those pieces. Yeah, look, it's been no problem. I'm glad, as you know, when I bring a self, I sense of myself to everything that I do. And that's just how I operate. So listen, thanks for listening to me. And let's hopefully I didn't go off on too many tangents. I repeat myself.
Really brilliant. Thank you so much.
Therapist Talk Therapy is a podcast by PCI College, Ireland's leading provider of third level education in counselling and psychotherapy. Please find out more by visiting pcicollege.ie.